children. We're starting.
That's right.
Showtime. Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. With Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 71 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audio2.com. And with me once again, Shelton Muller. How are you?
Hey, pretty good, Bruce. How yourself, mate?
Excellent.
Good to hear. Yeah, we're just excellent every week, aren't we?
We are.
Even if we say so ourselves. Yes. You know, I have, look, I must admit, I am very fortunate. I have this wonderful disposition to good health.
Yep.
Yesterday here in Australia was Anzac Day, and the 25th of April. And of course, in Australia, that's a very sort of an important date, and it commemorates a certain event. If you've seen the movie Gallipoli, it commemorates the Anzacs. Was it leaving, Bruce? Did they leave on the 25th of April?
No, wasn't that the day they landed?
Well, it might have been the day they landed. Yeah,
I thought that was the whole point of the commemorative day. For those who do not live in Australia or New Zealand and don't know what we're referring to, ANZAC stands for the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, which was a combined military force of Australian and New Zealand troops which went into the beachhead at Gallipoli in, I'm not sure what year it was. Was it
1915?
It was 15. I was going to say 15. I wasn't 100% certain. And
Gallipoli is in Turkey.
Is in Turkey, and it was a horribly managed campaign. The Turks were far superior force. They were well positioned on the cliffs above the beachhead, and it was an absolute slaughter. Probably one of our greatest military defeats of all time, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's celebrated here in Australia because it commemorates, I suppose, a lot of courage and idealism that just was abused by the commanding forces and the volunteer army of Australians and New Zealands were slaughtered. They say that I think I was reading at a little place called the Neck, which is about the size of a tennis court. There were hundreds, I think. Several hundred soldiers in that sort of space, just lying dead and wounded, because the forces just kept sending the soldiers over, even though they'd seen the slaughter.
Yeah.
They kept sending the soldiers over the trenches just to get machine gunned. And the final scene, if you do see the movie Gallipoli, it was made in the early 1980s here in Australia with Mel Gibson and another young actor whose name eludes
Mark
me.
Lee.
Mark Lee, thank you, Bruce.
No worries. Okay. It's funny we should mention this, because I was only looking at the DVD box yesterday. That's
okay.
Why I know that the guy's name.
Oh, there you go. I don't know that he went on to do much more,
no.
Mark, but it was one of Mel Gibson's early movies that brought him to fame. And the final scene in that movie, the final few seconds in that movie, basically tell you what Gallipoli was all about. But if you do get a chance to watch it, it's what yesterday here in Australia was commemorating.
Hmm.
Just to get back to the story, actually, my wife just recently purchased me a bicycle.
Yes, you mentioned that.
Yeah, just to sort of, get out and have a bit of a ride, which I love to do. And we went biking yesterday, and we rode over to friends' places and had a bit of a visit because it was a public holiday.
Yep.
And we did quite a few, about 30 Ks or something, which,
that's a good ride.
In a day. And I am not a rider. I'm not normally a fitness kind of person. I don't do gym or exercise or that much. I'm just, I have a natural health and fitness disposition, which I'm very fortunate to have. But my wife does a fair bit of gym and that kind of thing. But she got back from the ride aching and sore. And me, I don't feel a thing. I'm fine. I don't feel it. She
Tomorrow you'll
me.
Be flat on your back, pal.
No. Look, I was feeling fine. Today, the day after, not a problem.
Cool.
Not a problem. I mean, I just get up and I can, walk and hike and stuff, even though I don't normally do any of those kinds of workouts.
Yeah,
and not bad for, 44 years old now. So I'm pretty happy with that. But
excellent.
I went biking all day yesterday and don't feel a thing. No sense, no feeling, maybe, or something like that. But no, I'm feeling really great. Really, really great today.
Excellent.
And naturally, of course, for the bike ride, I carried my Ricoh GR Digital with me.
Of course.
Didn't shoot anything, but it had to have it on hand. Have you thought any more about a little compact for your cycling?
Actually, I must confess, I haven't been on the bike for a couple of weeks now, and I'm probably not going to get back on it now until September because the weather's got cold on me and I'm... I'm going to wuss out.
All right. Well, you live in Sydney. You want to talk about cold, mate.
Yeah,
come down
to
Melbourne.
I know, I know. But I find that, you know, if I get through that period from, say, March through to May, and I'm on the bike every day, well, not every day, but, you know, twice a week when I do go to work, I can generally cope with the change in temperature, and I'll then keep riding all through the winter. But you get a couple of weeks around this time of the year and you don't get on the bike, and then all of a sudden you wake up one May morning at 6 o'clock and you go, oh man, it's too bloody cold, I'm not riding this morning. And that's it, you know, you're just shot for the winter then.
Yeah, thank heaven for cars and fossil fuel.
Oh no, if I don't ride, I walk down to the bus stop, which is about a 10-minute walk from here, and then I catch a bus into Parramatta and a train from there. So
there you go. Well, if you're listening to this podcast and you see an incredibly good-looking guy on a bus on its way to Parramatta, then you know it's Bruce Williams. Go up and say good day. Give him a hug. You know, give him a hug. That's, you know, that's what he obviously, that's what he'll need, because he's feeling sad that he's not on his bike. I have some emails to read. I just wanted to get through these before, and then the final one we'll talk about the subject for today, so I'll get through a couple of these emails. I hope you don't mind, but you know that if you send me an email, there's every chance that I might read it.
Yep.
This one's from Paul Ballen. Hi, Paul. I really appreciate your sending this through. I'm going to read your entire email, maybe edited as I go. Let's see how we go. Hi, Shelton. Firstly, I would like to say how much I love your podcast. I'm sure he includes you in that, Bruce, because you're half of this thing, mate.
Right.
It really inspires me to get out there and get the best possible shot I can. I know how busy you are, but I would really appreciate if you give me your opinion on my situation. Now, this is the interesting thing. Paul is a teenager, and
we've featured some of his photography before.
And Paul, for mate, I wish at 17 I could shoot like you, because your work, you have an incredible eye and good technical skill. So let me just firstly say that. But I think I know the reason, one of the reasons why, is naturally you have a gift, Paul. But here's the other reason, and I'll continue with your email. For my 13th birthday, I got a Canon EOS 300. So at 13, Paul had an SLR.
Nice.
Beauty.
Yeah.
I had to be 17 before I got my first SLR. It came with a rather...
You were a deprived child.
I was a deprived child, yes. It was a Minolta SRT 101. That was my first camera.
Right.
It came with a rather plasticky 28-90 kit, as well as a 75-300 zoom. As time went on and I became more involved in photography, I decided that it would be a good idea to buy a 50mm. Therefore, I purchased a Canon 50mm 1.8 and a rather pricey 550 EX flash. I never had any problems with the camera, no sharpness issues, no focus issues. The only problems I had was that the camera felt rather amateurish and only had a sync speed of 1/90th, which was too slow for in-studio work.
Right.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think a 90th is too slow for studio work, because a studio, you know, a 90th is fine, especially if you're on a tripod, but a 90th really makes no difference, especially if you're working with studio apertures of f11, 16, 22, 8, whatever. I don't think you're going to get f8 at, you know, at 90th of a second in a dark room. But, you know, you have your own reasons for saying that, Paul, but that's not why you write. Therefore, I contemplated, he continues, buying a new camera, something a bit more professional, something with a nice body. I looked at an EOS 3 and a Nikon F100 and decided to get the F100. Beautiful camera, Paul, because of the compatibility of manual lenses and a sync speed of 1/250th and a nice range of digital SLRs. Good thinking. During the period I have had the camera, I have bought a new 50mm 1.8, used a 28 F3.5, as well as a 105 F4 macro. He says that these last two, the 28 and the 105, were manual focus lenses. The 50 was an autofocus. After a trip back from Cambodia, I realized that a large amount of my images were unsharp. I thought to myself that it might be because of camera shake, but it was on a trip and on self timer. But even some of the images shot at
F4. Did he mean trip or tripod?
It says, I think he means tripod, but it's written trip, yeah, but it was on a tripod, I'd say, he means, on a self-timer, and even some of the images shot at 5.6 or f8 in daylight weren't sharp. I found this extremely frustrating. I'm not confident at all with this camera at the moment, and I don't really know what I should do because I had no problems previously. Then he goes on to talk about, should he go back to Canon or should he stick with the Nikon? Because, you know, Nikon, he says, Nikon lead the way of camera technologies, or have led the way for in camera technology for years. Their lenses are said to be sharp and millions of people have used them in the worst conditions. People always say the camera doesn't matter and it's the eye, etc. And he continues. Then he asks, should I stay with Nikon or move back to Canon? I'm 17 now and really involved in photography, mainly shooting black and white film. So, I think, and then he talks about his awards and things like that. Well done, Paul. I first of all, admire all you've achieved for a 17-year-old fella. And your love of photography at that age is great, because a lot of 17-year-olds are sitting there playing, you know, all sorts of games and stuff. You're out taking pictures, so my hat's off to you. My answer is stay where you are. Not that I am saying one is better than the other, but I can't answer your question regarding sharpness. I have never had an issue with my lenses, and I use both Nikon lenses. I've had Takina lenses, I still do, and Tamron, and whatever's good, and never had an issue with sharpness. I would suggest that perhaps, you know, because they were manual focus lenses, there was something wrong. But that 105 macro that you have is one of the sharpest lenses ever made. So I cannot see why you would have a sharpness issue with that lens particularly. And so I would suggest staying where you are and getting back to the root of the problem. If you could get back to me with maybe a few JPEGs of what you're talking about, I would appreciate knowing, appreciate seeing, because it's hard for me to know. Sometimes a print can appear unsharp if you're, you know, in the dark room and haven't focused that correctly, but you seem to know what you're doing in the dark room, so I can't say that that's the issue. If it's been printed by a lab, then maybe that's the issue. Have you checked the negative itself for sharpness? That might be something you could look at. Maybe get the negative on a light table with a loop and have a look at the negative itself and see how you go. Get back to me, Paul, because if I can help, I certainly will. But I would only say at this stage, don't throw your money away, because I don't think it has anything to do with technology. Canon and Nikon are brilliant lenses, and their focusing is second, you know, their focusing technology is, well, you know, brilliant. The only other thing I could think of would be to perhaps check your focus screen for alignment. That might be out of alignment, but, you know, that's a tough call. Get back to me with some answers from that, Paul, and let me know how you go. But I don't think you should move camera systems, because I really don't think that that's your problem.
Could it have anything to do with filters that he might have on the ends of the lenses?
Could be the case. He hasn't mentioned it hasn't mentioned filters. I would say, though, that if that were the case, and this is something, you know, that he would have seen that through the viewfinder. But you know, probably he would have seen, you know, any amount of out of focus issues through the viewfinder as well. So why they're unsharp is difficult for me to get a hold on. I mean, look, are your lenses clean? Have you got, have you checked the rear element? If there's a mark or a scratch on the rear element, you're done for. Especially at smaller apertures, I would suggest that you stay where you are and get to the root of the problem. But I would doubt very much that it has anything to do with superior technology, because the difference is just not that much of an issue. So that's that one. Okay. Sorry, you were going to add?
No, I was just saying, okay, fair enough, move on.
Move on. All right, Andy Garcia. Now, this is not the actor Andy Garcia, but we've mentioned you before, Andy. Thank you very much for your email. Now, Andy has given us the review that we mentioned last week in the podcast that we really appreciated, and he sends some very complimentary words opening up his email. You guys are a class act. Well, he doesn't know us personally, so I suppose he can say that.
Obviously not.
Obviously not. Thanks a million for linking to my reviews of photography podcasts. Now, I just wanted to make Andy's website, if you available to you. I think you've mentioned it at audiotu.com, but it's capturedinlight.com.
Yeah, I did put a link up on the Shutters Inc. page.
And I'd suggest everybody go and have a look at Andy's website, because he has some great stuff in his blog that is of benefit to every photographer. Some really good freeware tips, reviews, podcasts, ours being at the top, of course. Some really good stuff there, Andy. Thank you very much. He suggests that we do something about Coke and filters in a future episode of this podcast, which we will, because he said, I heard you mention that you were the Australian dude for Coke and filters. And so he suggests that we do a show on Kokens, and why not? They are a good system. But he asks, I mentioned about polarizers being a little cool in their color cast. He hasn't seen that. I think you'll see it perhaps if you use a polarizer for flesh tones. Andy, take a picture of someone using the set your white balance manually for the lighting that you're in. Take a picture of a person without a polarizer and look at the difference. There is a little bit of cooling in a polarizing filter. If you don't see a difference, I'll be very surprised, and it would mean that you have one of the best polarizers out. So that would be just, you know, an answer to your question. He says, your mentioning of this cooling effect is the first I've ever heard, despite reading a ton of stuff on polarizers. Just another example of the wealth of knowledge you possess. Well, that's possible. Either that or I just could be wrong. But I'd give it a try, Andy, and let me know how you go. There's an experiment for you, because I know you've probably got tons of spare time to do my experiments. But I've found it particularly in working with flesh tones. If you're shooting a wedding or something, Andy, try doing that with a wedding and look at the difference in the color cast that you get, especially on flesh tones. Now, our final email is the one that I'm going to address today in greater detail, because we talked last week about the fact that we're going to start talking about light and, you know, using light to enhance our photographs, after a very nice compliment that one of our listeners gave about my photography. Holly, thank you. This is your email. So we're going to talk about your question here. You've got a few, but I just want to talk about your first paragraph. Before we get to that, Bruce, you wanted to mention, do you want to do this now, or do you want to do it at the end? You wanted to mention another email we received from a listener. About Flickr.
Oh, that wasn't an email.
You sent it.
I emailed the link to you. This was a...
Well, you're a listener. You're a listener, aren't you? You're listening right now,
I suppose,
you?
I pay attention while you're rabbiting on, yeah. Now, this was a story that I saw on TechCrunch through the week, which was Flickr, which I think most of our listeners would be familiar with, which is an online photographic repository where you can set up a free account and upload your photos, and you can either keep them private or you can share them so other people can see them. Flickr have done a sort of a deal with another site called ImageKind, and basically the deal is that ImageKind allows you to create a framed image which can be then sold. And so basically what they've done is they've teamed up. So if you've got a Flickr account where you've uploaded all these, you know, your favorite photos, you can now tie in with this service from ImageKind, which allows you to create framed prints, and you can then sell them online from your Flickr account. So I don't know the whole detail of it. I just saw the story and had a quick read of it and thought, well, that sounds pretty interesting and maybe of some interest to our listeners, particularly our American listeners. I'm not sure what the international ramifications of this are, how it works for people outside of America, but I'll put a link up to the TechCrunch article, and if anyone's interested in following it further, you can do so.
Look, we all love to see our work and sell a little bit of it, and yeah. You know, that sounds fabulous. So check out that link that's on the audiotu.com website.
For sure.
Or will be by the time this podcast is up and running.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Holly, let's get back to you. It says, hi, Bruce. Okay, well, she likes you more than me. all right. and then she says hello to you and your family. Well, I'm here too, Holly, okay? But, you know, fine if you think Bruce has got a sexier
don't
voice than me.
Don't worry about him, Holly.
I'm here too, Holly, okay? If you need some help from me, you know, here I am. Now, we love you, and thank you very much for your email. I'll just read your opening paragraph. I just listened to episode 66, where Shelton speaks about David Williams and his use of natural light for his photography. And yes, I did. Go back to that episode if you haven't heard it, because David Williams is one of Australia's most renowned photographers, and his studio is an available light studio. I went there to interview him once, and I was looking for softboxes and umbrellas and flash heads and couldn't see any. But the work that he produces, his understanding of light and the way he uses it, is just fabulous. Holly continues, to that end, I'm attaching a natural light shot I took of my son Noah this past Sunday. Well, a few Sundays ago now. I've been toying with the idea of picking up a flash for my 30D, if funds ever permit. I wonder if Shelton could speak... Oh, there I am, I'm mentioned, okay. And wondered if Shelton could speak about the difference between flash and natural light photography.
Oh, God, she's asked him to speak. We'll be here forever.
We will be, because I've got a big answer to this question. I love natural light, but it's not always available. On the other hand, I don't want to get too complicated with a lighting setup. I have a portfolio on iStock and also wonder if having a flash would enable me to capture some shots that I might not otherwise be able to do. I hope this would work out well for a discussion on the podcast. And Holly, the answer is yes, it does work out well for a discussion on the podcast. I think it's great because it's a great start up to our series on light. And we're going to be talking a lot about that because as I look through the work of photographers and I get sent a lot of emails and links with please look at my work, I see that there's one gaping hole that photographers, you know, often fail to fill, and that is the use of light. I photographed my nephew's wedding.
Which is kind of ironic, really.
Really, yes, because people think that it's all about composition. It's not. Composition is very important, but I've seen poorly photographed or poorly composed or average compositions with beautiful light that have still knocked my socks off in terms of image, because light has so many aspects to it that, you know, that create, you know, so much interest and wonder in an image. So light really is everything. As I was saying, I photographed my nephew's wedding on the Sunday just passed. And if you want to have a look at a few photographs, go to the blog that you can go to my blog that you can get to via my website on the news page, and there's a few photographs there. And he kept saying to me, Jacob, my young nephew, we were standing in this one spot at a place called the Briars, which is in on the Mornington Peninsula here in Victoria. Beautiful vineyard, and it's an old homestead, and it's gorgeous for wedding photography. And all I was doing for the first half hour or so that we were there was using the opening gate. And Jacob said, oh, are we going to go to any of the other spots, you know, while we're here? Uncle Shelton? Makes me feel so old. Uncle Shelton. I said, yeah, but mate, I'm just using this opening gate because I love the light here. And he says, oh, okay, with this sort of look on his face, you know, okay. And I said, look, have a look at a couple of the pictures I've taken of you just using the opening gate. And then he turned and had a look at the images on the screen, and he could see that he and his wife, they'd only been married an hour, Here they were, beautifully rim-lit with a vineyard behind them. And if you want to see a couple of shots, I'll send them to you, Bruce,
please.
We can put them up. They're just beautifully rim-lit, you know, shots in the late afternoon light at the place, at the Briars. And he just looked at me and as if to say, okay, right, I understand. I'll shut up now. I see what you're doing. You know, gave me a big hug and said, okay. And then he walked back to the position and, you know, did what I asked. I had rebuilt his confidence in his old Uncle Shelton. So off we went. We did some more photography using the late afternoon light. Yes, we did go to other spots. But the reason I raise this is because my creed, you might say, for photographing a wedding, as I've trained other photographers to think as best I can, is find the light and put him in it. And I've often said that on this podcast. Yep. Find the light and put him in it. However, Holly's talking about flash. She says she loves natural light. Well, so do I. But yes, it's not always available. So the key is to try to make flash look as much like available light as possible. And there are ways that you can do that. The worst kind of flash that we have often spoken about is the full frontal, you know, on camera, you know, pop-up flash or hot shoe mounted flash that just, you know, fires down the axis of the lens
at full power and obliterates all natural light.
You know, hey, boom. And you know, we end up looking like deer in the headlights.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, this is me, boom. And you know, I still see a lot of professional, and I put that word in inverted commas, wedding photography done that way. And I very, very rarely use full frontal flash techniques. If I'm shooting maybe an event and I have to snap around the place, I do that, but I try to, you know, make it as not objectionable as possible. But let's talk about a few techniques that we can use to make flash look more like natural light and still have the advantage of flash, because flash is fabulous. It really is. It's like having, you know, pocket light. But you can make it look more natural than often, you know, it's portrayed as. First of all, I would suggest, Holly, yes, if funds do permit, get the right flash for your 30D. I would suggest buying the best flash technology that you can afford and the most powerful flash that you can afford in that range. I use, you know, the Nikon flash. I love using the ITTL mode, which is, you know, the Nikon's off-camera wireless flash mode. Basically, what it means is that you can use, you know, your camera and flash combination off-camera, and they talk to each other wirelessly for exposure. It's just brilliant. You can put your camera on full auto and bang away. I walked around my nephew's wedding reception with my left arm out, holding my flash and my camera up to my eye. You know, I got a very sore arm. I looked like, you know, I was signaling all night, but I had my flash in my hand because I love ITTL. I'm going to tell you why I did that in a minute. But if you haven't got a wireless flash mode, and not every camera has one, buy an off-camera cord. Now, the first Nikon camera I had was a Nikon 801, and you could buy what they called an SC17 cord, which was a coiled cord, and one end, you know, went on your hot shoe, and the other end connected to your flash, and you could do the same sort of thing. And it was all TTL, but it was a cord, of course, so you only could, you know, hold it out so far or have it so far removed from the camera. But it was still fabulous, and you can still do that. There's still cords that allow you to connect your camera to your flash and have all the TTL, you know, camera talking to flash technology that you can. I would, first of all, suggest that you learn to do that and get that if you possibly can. So buy the flash and, you know, and then make sure that you can some way use it, you know, off camera. Depending on what flash and camera you have. If you have to buy a connecting cord, do so. But that one of the first ways that you need to move on from, you know, where we usually are with flash is often taking the thing off camera to some degree. We used to use flash, well, we still do use flash brackets, but they still don't remove the flash far enough away from the lens, you know, to give it enough dimensionality.
Yeah. Or from the axis of the lens, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that is really the key to poor flash photos, or improving upon poor flash photos, is dimension. The problem with full frontal flash is not only that it often wipes out, you know, any sense of texture, but it removes dimensionality from our pictures, if that's a word, because the shadows are always, you know, behind the subject. There's no shape, there's no shadow to create any sense of dimension. So what we often left with is very little sense of wonder as to how the shape is, how deep it is, how broad it is, how, you know, wide it is, whatever, because we've fired this light straight into the person's face or the subject, you know, and created very little form. So taking the flash off camera, round to our right or round to our left, is one of the first ways that we can make you know, our flash seem a little less objectionable. I'll also upload a couple of photos that, yes, I took of the dance floor during the evening, where it was, yeah, just me walking around with the ITTL technology banging away. And yes, they are flash photos, but the shutter speed was slow enough that I got available light. You know, I got the lighting on the dance floor, and also the camera, the flash rather, the light comes from my left, and so it immediately casts shadows where full frontal flash wouldn't, so that, you know, you're lighting one side of the face more than the other, and therefore creating, you know, there's a shadow in the nose, there's a shadow on the dark side of the face. So you get an idea of the shape of the person's face, and you get a more natural lighting effect. So that's the first thing I'd suggest that you do. You can also bounce the flash. Now, most of us know that. You bounce the light off a wall, off a ceiling. You know, you can even carry a bit of white cardboard around. I was doing a shoot yesterday, and I needed just to do a quick flash photo away from where my portable studio setup was. And I grabbed a piece of white card that was just in this room. Just there it was, bit of white cardboard. And I just held it, you know, held my flash into it and reflected the light off it. And it created a very natural lighting effect. We've got to sort of think on our feet when we're talking flash here. How do I diffuse this? How do I reflect this? How do I make it look less harsh, less full on? You can shoot through things. You got a white handkerchief. There's an instant scrim. Now, a scrim is basically a translucent panel that you shoot, that you can shoot light through.
Is that like a diffuser?
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's like a diffuser for your flash. Now, people have said, oh, look, if you put a bit of, you know, lens cleaning tissue over your flash, you know, away you go, and it's rubbish. It's not strong enough, and it's too close to the flash itself to really make a lot of difference. It does make a little bit of difference, but no big deal. But you can use a larger sheet of material, some translucent, you know, material to, you know, diffuse your flash with, but, you know, spread the light out. If you pull your flash back from that and use maybe something that's a couple of feet across or a couple of feet square, you know, then your light is immediately diffused and broadened and softer and therefore more natural. I remember one of the first commercial shoots I had to do, and I had such little equipment that I had to do this shot of a drill, an electric drill for an ad, and it was this client I really wanted, and, you know, I'd sort of, you know, sold him the story that I could do it, and I had no studio flash equipment, but I had a flash gun, and I went down, I went into my kitchen, I got a white, you know, those white sort of crumply shopping bags that you get, you know, when you go down to the shop.
And like a plastic shopping bag.
Yeah. The little thin, crumply little. I blew air into it, wrapped it round the flash with an elastic bag, so it, you know, and so I had this puffy white bag on the end of my flash, and I held that over the drill like you would a softbox in a studio, and used that for my lighting, and it worked fabulous.
Excellent.
You know, necessity is the mother of invention, but it taught me that it really is about thinking, how do I affect this light? How do I alter this light so that it is, you know, softer, less directional, whatever?
Yeah.
And those sort of homemade things often work well when you really need them. But literally, you can get, if you get a bit of PVC piping and you form a frame and you attach, you can make yourself a little scrim or diffuser that you carry around and, you know, use to soften your flash. You can mix your flash, as we talked about recently, with ambient, you know, by what we call dragging the shutter. In other words, a slow shutter speed mixed with flash. You can do rear curtain flash, which we also talked about recently. So there are all these ways to use flash and have it look a little more natural.
Did you just very quickly want to explain how to balance between ambient and flash?
Yes, certainly. There's a lot of ways that you can do that, and the principle is that you meter for ambient and then allow your flash. Now, you can use TTL technology or thyristor technology to do this, but you allow your flash to fire, but if it's TTL, the camera will basically say, hey, I've got a fair bit of exposure already. I don't need that much flash, so it won't use as much flash to expose. So what you'll get is a mixture of, you know, flash exposure, which is good for white balance often, and, you know, especially if you're working under tungsten and that kind of thing, you get the right white balance with the flash, and you allow through the exposure that you've set for the, you know, the room or wherever it is you are to, you know, fill in the rest of that. You can even set it up so that your shutter speed is slightly faster, making the background, you know, the room you're in or whatever circumstance you're in, ambient light darker, and therefore your flash more prominent. And if you play with that, you actually can control the balance between how much of the room or the environment in which you're taking your photograph is visible in the image and how much the flash is visible, balancing, you know, between the two. With fill flash outdoors, you can also, you know, balance that very differently as well. By sometimes fill flash looks very obvious. And a technique I learned before I had through the lens, technology, metering technology with flash, was the thyristor technology. Now, thyristor technology was where the flash itself had a meter inbuilt. And it had a little sensor on the front of the flash that, would sense how much light the subject that it was pointing to had received and tell the flash enough and turn it off. And it would do that, you know, within an incredibly short fraction of a second. The flash, at the back of the flash, it would tell you what aperture you had to set on your camera according to what ISO film you were using in order for the flash and the camera to be compatible in terms of exposure. But we learned, and I was taught this at a wedding studio that I was shooting for, to balance that off by saying, by telling your camera, you know, or telling your flash really, that it only had to expose for f4, but we would set our camera to 5.6 or 8. And so therefore the flash fired thinking, oh, well, it's f4 and there's plenty of, you know, light out here or whatever, but the camera was set at 5.6 or 8, so and the shutter speed set accordingly for the 5.6 or f8 exposure, so that the flash didn't actually fire that much. It wasn't overdone. It was just nicely, you know, filled. These days, most flash guns on the back of them, you can say, you know, look, I want one stop under or half a stop under, or Galen Rowell's magic 1.7 stops under for fill flash. So experiment with that.
Most SLRs have also got a flash compensation dial on them as well, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And is that's exactly the same process?
I believe most of them would probably refer to the pop-up flash on the SLRs these days.
Right.
The flash system that I use, the Nikon system, and the others that I'm compatible with, you usually set that on the flash itself.
Okay.
If you learn to play between the camera's exposure and the flash exposure, there are, we could do podcast after podcast after podcast on the combinations available to you with camera exposure and flash exposure, especially these days, considering you have so many technologies available to you. Tweaking them, working with them, is part of the fun and the creativity and, you know, the technical side of photography that you can learn to master, so that, Holly, you can make your flash look like it is natural light. I remember shooting with Greg Galen Rowell when he came down to Australia years ago. This was a few years before he sadly got killed in a light plane crash. And we went out early one morning, and Galen was a great natural photographer. And he never liked, like, he would use a polarizer and a grad. That was the extent of the filters that he would use. But he had no problem using flash, because he would use it to light foregrounds in a landscape or highlight certain parts of the landscape in the foreground with flash in order to balance off the exposure or to, you know, create a little more interest in the image. We were out shooting early one morning in Hobart in Tasmania, and he pulled out his camera and his flash, set it up on the coiled cord that we were talking about before, the SC17, and then he got a bit of orange cellophane and put it with an elastic band and wrapped it around the front of his flash and proceeded to illuminate this entire gum tree, which was being lit on one side from the sun early in the morning, the sunrise, and he filled it a little bit on the other side with this flash firing with a bit of orange cellophane, so that he would have it didn't look unnatural. He'd set the flash to only just, you know, fill it a little bit, but he wanted a little more detail on the dark side of the tree, because he knew that while the eye could see it, the film, the Velvia he was using, was probably going to be a little too contrasty, and he wouldn't actually capture all the detail on the dark side or the shadow side of the tree. So he used the flash that way. When you see the final image, you'd never know that he actually used flash. And there are some great websites available for flash photography. One that looking at earlier from popphoto.com, and there's a PDF you can download, and I'll give you the link to that so that you can download the flash techniques PDF on that. There are some. There's one at planetneil.com, and he also has some great flash techniques, and he goes into those. There are great ways to use flash, Holly, that are not what you're probably used to seeing, and that is the blammo full frontal attack with flash that we often see. I love flash. I just hate the kind of flash that we often see being used, but I use flash a lot. I really do, both inside and outside. I just make it look as if I haven't, or that it at least is not the full frontal kind of flash that we're so used to seeing. So, Holly, my answer to your email is get the flash for your 30D and start fooling around with it. Your portrait of Noah that you sent is lovely.
Yeah.
And it's available. It is nice, isn't it, Bruce?
Yeah, it's great.
And if you don't mind, maybe we'll put it up because it's a great shot. But I think you could have achieved the same result with flash if you had to, or extremely similar result with flash if you had to, just by knowing how to use it, where to place it, what to shoot through, what to shoot against or off of, how to meter, all those things. And there are photographers who are flash experts and hardly take a picture without flash, but none of their pictures look like they've actually used flash. And that's the key to good flash use. The technology is there, and also our brain is quite capable of sorting out and tweaking those technologies so that we really can enjoy flash and use it, especially when we have to, if we're in a situation where shooting strictly available light is just not going to happen. Working with flash is fabulous, provided we know how to make it look good. And that's the key to it. So buy that flash, Holly. Get stuck into it. And I want you to take a few of these tips from this podcast, use them, and let us know how you go.
Absolutely. All right, mate. Well, thank you for that.
No worries. That's a pleasure. We're going to continue this theme more about light. Yeah. Next week, what light does, why we should be very conscious of it, because of its effect in terms of creating three dimensions from two, and also its emotional effect. We're going to be talking about all these things over the next few weeks in our podcast. So we'll be answering your emails as best possible, and then just throwing in a few tips on using light in our photography, because photography is writing with light. That's what the Greek means.
That's it.
So if we don't understand that, we really aren't at the heart of our photography yet. No. That's a key. Composition is one thing, as we said, but light is everything.
Fantastic. All right, Shelton, will you take care?
You too, Bruce. You too, and in regards to all our listeners.
Yep.
Thanks for the emails. Very much appreciated.
Absolutely.
All right. Oh, and one more thing. One more thing. Graham, have a great time in Europe, mate. I wish I was traveling with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We want to see some photos when you get back. All
definitely.
Right? Terrific.
All right, mate. Talk with you next week.
You bet. See you soon. Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.